So, Marty Moss, Coaim, do you depend exclusively on a landline telephone? If the answer is yes, you're part of a shrinking group of Americans who haven't cut the cord yet and opted for a cell phone. Telecommunication companies are also moving away from copper wires that are expensive to replace. But are internet-based phones better than the traditional landline? We're going to begin our conversation with Brian Fung, and he is technology reporter at the Washington Post, joining us from their studios. And Brian, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So what percentage of the population still relies almost exclusively, or let's say exclusively, on a landline telephone?
Well, the sort of proportion of people using landlines has been dropping over time. And the FCC has said that, as that transition continues, one of the things that it wants to do is to accelerate the move to fiber optic phone networks. So right now, most of our telephone systems operate on old copper lines, which is basically the same technology that we used when the telephone was invented. This transition would basically turn most phone calls into essentially internet data.
In fact, our engineers here at WHYY refer to POTS, which means plain old telephone service. This is the sort of the landline copper wire-based communication system.
That's right. And, there's a lot that we haven't yet figured out that will go into this technological transition. And so one of the things that phone companies are beginning to do is to run test trials of this technology to see what exactly is going to happen. Are our 911 calls going to be disrupted? Are, the way that we pay for phone calls going to be different in the future? And so those tests are going to be crucial to finding out, how this transition is going to move forward and who will be affected.
It costs something like, almost $1 billion a year to maintain or perhaps repair these copper lines?
That's right. And the phone companies say that, if only they could spend less on maintaining those old phone lines, which a shrinking proportion of Americans are using, they could then funnel those resources into upgrading the new, much faster fiber optic services, which can also support, by the way, new features such as HD quality voice, video calls, and more features like that.
If we're talking about the plain old telephone service POTS, is it a generational shift, or are there parts of the country that are more reliant on this older technology?
Well, I think it's fairly fair to say that in rural areas or places that don't have very good internet access, where it's expensive to build internet infrastructure, that those areas would be potentially left out of this IP transition. And so one of the things that the FCC has suggested as one of the goals for these test trials is just finding out, who might be left without phone service and what mm-hmm. alternatives we could adopt to mitigate that.
Is there any reason to keep POTS, plain old telephone service, a landline, for instance?
Sure. One of the common tropes when it comes to phone service is that the copper lines, can typically run without electricity, whereas today's fiber-based systems require at least a backup battery. And once that battery runs out, during a crisis or a blackout, then you're pretty much stuck without phone service. So the question is, should we require phone companies to include batteries, and if so, how large should those batteries be to ensure that people still have service when the power goes out?
As a show that relies on telephones, either for callers or for guests, I have to say, and the engineers will back me up on this, one of my complaints is just the variable quality when it comes to phone lines, calling out to a guest or even callers coming into the show. Sometimes they sound good, sometimes they sound terrible.
Yeah, and you may have had this problem too, having guests call in from a cell phone. The cell phone quality is probably not as good as a landline or being in a studio. And so in the future, the technology that underlies this transition could make it so that voice calls, even from wireless phones, would be much improved.
And so you're saying that the future things will get better in the future?
That's the hope.
That's the hope.
There's There's a lot of possibilities that are being opened up as a result of these new fiber optic phone lines. The question, however, is whether or not we ought to regulate those telephone lines differently from the way that we historically regulated phone companies. This is also wrapped up in, you know, questions about net neutrality, which your listeners may also have been following as well.
Well, let me just follow up on that, because this is an important distinction, which is that the FCC monitors, or I guess has control over the internet or what happens on the internet. And when we're talking about copper lines, it's a public utility. So are there different regulations, different consumer protections based on the internet versus landlines?
There are. Currently, telephone service is regulated under, and this is about to get a little bit wonky, but bear with me.
Okay.
Telephone service is regulated under a part of the communications law called Title II. And this is the law that of the Communications Act, I should say. And the Communications Act is the law that gives the FCC its sort of grant of authority. It tells the FCC what it can and can't do. And you know, the phone companies have historically been regulated under Title II of the Communications Act, whereas broadband companies, internet companies like Verizon or AT&T or Comcast have been regulated under a different part of the law, a part of the law known as Title I. The question is whether or not, as phone service moves away from the old copper telephone lines and becomes essentially an internet product, when every phone call becomes a Skype call, essentially, or a Google Voice call, you know, whether those calls should be regulated under Title II, just like the old telephone system was.
I mean, that's wonky, but that's important.
Absolutely. And it's at the heart of one of the big policy questions happening at the FCC right now. There's a lot of back and forth about, you know, well, subjecting internet providers to Title II regulation, does that open the door to the FCC, you know, potentially regulating companies like Google or Netflix? That's an argument that some internet providers have made. Now, it's not quite clear, you know, what the actual implications of that are. It's unclear, you know, whether or not, given the opportunity, the FCC would try and regulate Google or Netflix. I think it's one thing to say, you know, that using a law or the possibility of using a law to do something inevitably means that the law will be used to do that thing. So there are a lot of questions here that still are unresolved.
Indeed. And that's Brian Fung, technology reporter at The Washington Post, and giving us a bit of an update on some of the changes that might be coming to your telephone system. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me actually, because John had a question I wanted to raise, and John from Shillington joining us on Radio Times. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm the owner. I'm calling you, by the way, on a landline phone, and I'm the owner of both landline service and cell phone service, but I find that the most useful thing for my landline at the current time is sometimes finding my cell phone in the morning if it's dropped down the couch or in the bed or something like that.
But
my father was an engineer for Bell Laboratories, and you know, I'd ask him about, well, how long are the phones designed to last? And he said, oh, they're engineered for like 100 years of service, those old handsets, and the copper wiring and stuff was very robust. I wonder, with the cell phone sometimes, you know, I have an Android phone, and I know that iPhones are susceptible too. Sometimes you have so much software loaded on it that it gets a little buggy, and sometimes needs to be tuned up and whatever. And yet the landline is always dependable, and I wonder how well the old systems would hold up if there were a massive solar flare or something like that.
Well, John, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And the question, I guess, for you, Brian, is the kind of reliability, comparing the reliability of a landline versus a cell phone.
That's a great question. And, you know, one of the things that really makes a big difference here, as John was pointing out, is that there's so many more parts to a wireless system. You've got the handset, and then you've got the connection to the cell tower, and then, you know, on the handset you may have all different sorts of apps and software that are all interacting with each other, whereas with the old telephone system was just a handset and a phone line. So there's definitely a lot more variables when it comes to wireless, that's for sure. You know, I think one of the sort of interesting pieces of this discussion is that, you know, handsets are also kind of almost engineered to be recycled or thrown away after 2 years, because most people are on a 2-year contract cycle, and so you know, your phone gets old, and then you get a new one. And so there are a lot of questions surrounding the reliability of phones, and this actually came up in a couple of years ago in Fire Island after Hurricane Sandy. Fire Island is a region of New York that was pretty hard hit by the hurricane. Verizon came in and said, hey, we're going to, you know, replace all these copper phone lines with wireless service because it would be too expensive to replace all the infrastructure that was damaged by the storm. And the citizens on Fire Island sort of revolted because the quality of service was actually really bad. And so Verizon later backed down and said, okay, we're actually going to install high-speed fiber optic lines to each and every home through Fios, and that's how you're going to get your phone service. But for a while there, you know, the residents on Fire Island faced the prospect of having only cell phone service being essentially their replacement for landlines.
And Brian, I was there was some question about whether you can call 911 as easily on your cell phone as your landline. Is there a difference there?
Just in terms of the technology, you know, there's all sorts of protocols that need to be designed to handle 911. For example, this isn't strictly about 911, but it's pretty close. In an emergency, you know, public officials are given a special card that has a specific phone number that they can dial. If they dial that phone number and enter in their PIN, their you know, personal identification number, they'll get special access to the phone system, and their call will be routed first before anyone else's. Ah. And so the question that, you know, some government agencies have had for the SEC, the Department of Homeland Security actually asked the FCC about this specific issue, is during this trial, you know, what happens to that system of prioritization? Do public officials, will they continue to receive these public prioritization benefits, or are their calls going to be routed through the same systems as everyone else in a crisis? You know, as we saw during Hurricane Sandy or during 9/11, wireless systems can get pretty congested in a crisis. And so, you know, as a public official, you would be very concerned about getting to first responders or communicating with the White House, you know, as the transition moves forward. So that's one big question.
Indeed. Well, many questions remaining. Brian Fung, thanks once again for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And technology reporter at the Washington Post. We have two guests waiting in the wings. We'll be talking less about the technology and more about the sociology or psychology of the telephone. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Amtrak, featuring patripsbytrain.com, offering train packages to destinations along Amtrak's Keystone service line. More information on available excursion packages at patripsbytrain.com.
Whether you're just waking up or you're on your commute, the news is always happening. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. WHYY and NPR's reporters are covering the stories around the block and across the globe that will fuel your day and keep you informed.
So if your alarm is set to 90.9 or we're the first preset on your car's radio,
it's radio so vibrant you can almost see it.
And our reporters never take shortcuts.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, a guide to saving for retirement when it's decades away, and it starts with skipping that latte.
Pay yourself first, and what I mean by that is just putting that money away into the 401k plan and just pretend it's gone forever.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The telephone has revolutionized communication since it was invented more than 100 years ago and continues to influence and shape the 21st century. Just to get into our little time travel machine, we're going to go back to 1954. And this is a Bell Systems telephone commercial explaining how to dial a telephone. They were in the process of being converted from operator-based to a dial-tone system. Let's listen.
There are a few easy rules to be followed when dialing, because careless dialing mistakes will waste a lot of your time and cause someone else to be inconvenienced and probably irritated. When you want to make a call, always be sure you have the right number. Consult your directory for any number you're not sure of. Write the number down, like this. It will save you a lot of time and trouble if you keep the numbers in front of you while dialing.
That's how to dial a telephone. Joining us now, Keith Hampton, Associate Professor in the Department of Communication, School of Communication and Information, and an affiliate member of the Graduate Faculty in Sociology at Rutgers University, also Chair of the Social Media and Social and Society Cluster in the School of Communication and Information. Keith Hampton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And joining us by telephone is Claude Fisher, Professor of Sociology at the University of California at Berkeley, author of a book called America Calling, A Social History of the Telephone to 1940. And Claude Fisher, I interviewed you on that book when it first came out many, many years ago, and it's nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you. It has legs.
It certainly has legs and takes me back, I'm sad to say, to my, not so sad, but just surprised to say that was my youth, going from the telephone where you picked it up and there was the operator and she would connect you to your friend, going to that to a phone where you actually had to dial the numbers to get what you wanted. We've been talking about just how much phones have revolutionized how we communicate with each other. What were the phone companies thinking people were going to do with the phone in the early days?
Well, the very early days of the telephone in the late 19th century, and I think I'll just pause this to tell your younger listeners that there was a time when the telephone industry was a monopoly of one company, the Bell Company, with a 20-year window very early in the 20th century. In those early days, the phone company was very much modeled on the telegraph system, and the idea was that this device was a practical thing. Businessmen would use it to do business, and you might have one in the home in order to do the business of the home, to order groceries, to call the police, and so forth. And they were very much oriented toward a business idea of the telephone. And about a generation later, they learned that there were other ways people were intending to use this device.
But they never thought that this would be how people, you know, not business people, but just everybody was going to use this to talk to each other?
With the exception of a couple odd visionaries who were thought to be sort of crackpots in the business, no. The idea was, again, very much modeled on the telegraph, and Americans did not use telegraph for casual communications. But what did happen by the beginning of by the 1920s was that Americans did with the landline telephone, to a great extent, what they did with the cell phone, which was to use it for all sorts of casual personal purposes, and including just chatter.
Perish the thought. So were there, and I do want to get to Keith Hampton in just a moment or two, but to you, Claude Fisher, were there some of the same worries that the telephone, you know, the telephone maybe in the vestibule or something was going to ruin family conversation?
Well, there were a number of anxieties. One of them was, and Mark Twain was very famously quoted on this, that the phone would, the ringing of the phone would disrupt people, disorient people, make people nervous and anxious. There's also the concern that there were phone conversations that could be had that were not supervised, whether it was when the husband was away, the phone conversations of his wife, or teenagers on the telephone. There were all sorts of worries about what this new device would create, as well as some sort of very over-the-top claims for how it would be the salvation of humanity. So there was a lot of speculation at the time.
Let me get you in on the conversation, Keith, and you're nodding your head as Claude Fisher is talking. Some interesting parallels between the first introduction of the telephone and now these devices that we're all rather plugged into.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, we have this belief that the grass was always greener in the past, whether we're talking about community or technology. You know, the same things that, you know, Professor Fisher just described about landline phones are said every day about cell phones. You know, it's hard to deny that they're a new social presence in everyday life, but there's the same kind of utopian feeling that they bring so much promise, and the same kind of concern that it's going to lead to isolation and disengagement and all sorts of problems with youth and supervision.
Do you think it's because of it's the telephone, or this is how we look at new technology? I mean, is there something sort of unique about the phone that creates both this euphoria and anxiety?
I don't think it has anything to do with the phone in particular. I mean, we fear this about everything. We've feared the written word, the teletype, the, you know, the phonograph. I'm sure every single technology has been met with a similar kind of wonderful utopian feeling and kind of general distrust. And it's probably very healthy, but it's probably not unique to cell phones or landline phones.
Well, as we know, and I'm not saying anything new here, I mean, phones are more than just that phone that we used to answer in our homes. I mean, a phone is your whole life. All the information is in that little gizmo in your hand.
Yeah, I sense a little bit of angst when you say that.
Well, I feel both sides of this, which is it's wonderful. You know, I can text my son in San Francisco whenever I want.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest shifts as a result of the technology really is a movement away from kind of home-to-home communication, which is, you know, a nature of the landline phone. You would dial from one home to another, and usually the female head of household would pick up, and it would go from there. But cell phones are a very unique technology in that you're now talking individual to individual. And during an emergency or any kind of situation, being able to reach out to your teenage son or anyone else can be really valuable.
Claude, I'd love to hear what you have to say.
About these speculations?
Well, even about whatever the anxiety is that some people have about telephones.
Well, I think there's the issue generally of technologies, which come with this package of a uncertain future and the fear of upsetting current circumstances and the way we live today. And then the telephone itself is an interesting device in terms of it's sort of such a social device, unlike many of our technologies that have to do with the workday world, whether it's new forms of window glass or new kinds of synthetic fabrics. It's a device that that focuses very much on the person, and it has, I think, a whole set of anxieties built into it. So, for example, one of the anxieties about the cell phone is that, and Keith Hampton has done an interesting study along these lines, one of the anxieties about the cell phone is, since it puts you in communication with anybody in the world at any time, does that mean you're now going to be ignoring the person in front of you?
Right.
Just like a century ago, some men would complain that having their wives on the phone talking to their mothers or their girlfriends sort of diverted their wives' attention from themselves. It's a similar sort of thing, but it's a very intensely social device, the communication parts of it, and that's one of the unusual aspects of the cell phone, or the telephone and the cell phone as a technology compared to a lot of the other technologies we talk about.
Well, Keith, you've done some really fascinating research where you and your fellow researchers just watch people on their cell phones. What's the takeaway of that?
Right. So we've done a number of studies along these lines now. The most recent was a comparative study where we looked at some video that were taken by another sociologist 30 years ago of people hanging out in public spaces. And then we went back and filmed those same spaces more recently and did a comparison about what had changed. And we observed about 150,000 people as part of that study. So it was fairly extensive. But I know, I think what we learned most is that, you know, yes, you know, cell phones are out there and we have this fear that's leading to disengagement. But most people that we observed, they were using the mobile phone when they were alone. They were using it when they were walking down the street by themselves. Women were using it presumably as a means for preserving their safety. People weren't using it in groups very often. It was the least common thing. I think about 98% of cell phone users that we observed were using it by themselves and weren't letting it interrupt those group communication. Not to say it doesn't happen, but it's just not as prevalent as we might think.
So this idea of being alone together, that's a phrase that I ran across. You're saying not so fast?
Yeah, I would say not so fast in terms of the mobile phone and probably not so fast in terms of societal change in general. I mean, again, we think the grass was kind of always greener, but a lot has changed over the last 30 years besides just introducing new technologies. I mean, we certainly observed that, in the last 30 years, there are a lot more women in public spaces than there were before, and that's leading to a lot more groups, a lot of more men and women walking together, and those social changes are probably far more important than technological change.
And that's Keith Hampton. He's associate professor in the Department of Communication at Rutgers University and has been doing some fascinating research on how people use cell phones, observational research, also with Claude Fisher. He's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called America Calling, A Social History of the Telephone to 1940. We're talking about the past, present, and future. And we'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Claude, let me put this to you because I put this to Keith before the show began, and I see this generally with younger people, if I can say that, having a kind of seamless ability to talk in groups, to text somebody, to check something out, Google something, and using these devices in what feels like a very integrated, seamless kind of way. And I don't know whether, I'd be curious about whether you have observed that.
Well, it is very interesting. I once wrote a short column about the common complaint that people were too engaged in their devices to pay attention to each other. It noted that if you go to restaurants in high-end places, everybody's got their cell phone on the table, and you'd think everybody would have head down texting away, but in fact the places are really damn noisy because everybody's talking at everybody. So there is this sort of new way of integrating this technology in which people, and again, I would agree with you, younger than I are better at it, in which you can go from talking to the person in front of you to checking with a friend who may be on the other side of the country and bringing that friend into the conversation and then going back. These are ways people start to adapt to technologies and use them. And again, the striking thing to me is that how social they are. I'll give you another anecdote. I remember,
sure, go ahead.
I'm old enough to remember when the Walkman sound system came in and you would read stories in the press about how the world was going to hell in a handbasket because all these people were walking down the streets just listening to their music and totally disengaged. Fast forward a good 20 years or so, and you read similar columns about how you can't get people on the train to shut up from talking to their friends all the time, overhearing their cell phone conversations. And so we, in terms of sort of the public commentary, we shift from worries about people being cut off to worries about people being too engaged. I think Keith's point that maybe we should step back and have a longer perspective on these things is well taken.
Well, picking up on the public transportation part of the conversation, Keith, what I notice is that people speak very loudly on their cell phones, and I think it's because you don't get the kind of feedback that you get on a landline phone where the phone is sort of telling you how loud, you can hear how loud you are, but on a cell phone, you can't, so people are shouting.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is some evidence to suggest that that was, you know, kind of a learning and generational difference. And I don't think we actually observe people in general talking as loudly on their cell phones as they used to. And I'm sure Claude could, you know, talk a little bit about early adoption of landline phones and how loudly people tended to think.
Hello?
Hello, anyone there? You know, I imagine it was the exact same kind of learning. Maybe we need an ad on how to use our cell phones in public. But, you know, different technologies, different affordances. And certainly when we were watching people using their mobile phones in public spaces, we were also watching people using their music devices. And I think there's something to be said that those people were, you know, far less aware of their surroundings than people using any other technology, even, you know, reading a newspaper. They were cut off and weren't aware when people were trying to get their attention. So there is something to this.
Have you looked at people at home, how families or people that live together, how they use their devices?
We've done a few national surveys to look at how interaction in the household and interaction with people more broadly is changing. The best examples still probably come from my own household.
I'm thinking my household, yeah, too.
It's hard to ignore. I mean, yesterday, you know, Father's Day, and you're wrestling with, you know, balancing screens with family time, and that's a daily occurrence, and it's probably not new. I still remember, you know, the conflicts I'd have with my family over television as a child, and I think that those same conflicts are replicated today.
What do you think, Claude Fisher?
Yeah, I think there's a sort of constant generational struggle over how to integrate new things, and people are orient differently. I think there's a lot, if you expand this to a sort of discussion of the computer world, I think there's some persuasive evidence that people develop new cognitive skills. I think my son is probably very unlikely to really understand how to read a map when a device can just tell him to turn left and turn right. But these are skills and sort of habits that people learn and they adjust. And the striking thing to me is along the lines that Keith was pointing out, that people employ these technologies for sort of purposes and ends that are very much driven by their, you know, life interests, their social position, the tasks they have at hand. And I think that's a way to understand them, is how different generations take a hold of these technologies and use them. And again, I've always been struck in the work I've done is the extent to which the number one use, perhaps you could say, is the social use, that is staying in touch with people, even the person who's hooked into their audio system with their earbuds, all those systems get interrupted by a phone call from outside, which means it's somebody important to you wants your attention. It's grabbed. And there's probably just a lot more volume of person-to-person communication than there was before, for better or for worse.
And we're almost up at a break here, Keith, but I do think there's something rather Skinnerian when the phone goes off, or the ring, or the buzz, or the beep, or the whatever. The impulse is to sort of drop everything and pick up the phone and look at the screen.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly some truth to that, and we do have to look at, you know, who we are calling. You know, I think that there may be some truth to concerns that we are calling the same number of people more frequently than we had in the past, and that those really close relationships may be privileged at the expense of some kind of more diverse relationships. But it could also be said that, you know, back in the landline days, that it's hard to ignore that ringing telephone at the dinner table as well.
And that's Keith Hampton, associate professor in the Department of Communication at Rutgers University. Also with us, Claude Fisher, professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. Keith Hampton has been doing research looking at how people use their cell phones. Claude Fisher wrote a book called America Calling, A Social History of the Telephone to 1940. We want to know how you use your telephone. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radio.com/times@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Fight supports WHYY and presents the 20th annual AIDS Education Month. Events, conferences, and workshops throughout June to increase HIV awareness and find strategies to end the AIDS epidemic. Featuring Nobel Prize winner Françoise Barré-Sinoussi, noted author and civil rights advocate Michelle Alexander, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, and Grammy nominee Wale in a concert on National HIV Testing Day. All events are open to the public. More at AIDSEducationMonth.org.
In your statement, you said that you came home and found your wife, that she was already dead?
Downstairs, yeah. That's Deputy Sheriff Molly Salverson interviewing a suspect in the new FX series Fargo, based on the popular Coen Brothers film. On the next Fresh Air, we meet series creator and writer Noah Hawley and Allison Tolman, who plays the deputy. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Creativity is a common theme that drives both entrepreneurs and artists. But creative people are often paradoxical, combining playfulness and discipline, or responsibility and irresponsibility. It's been recognized as so important that businesses are setting up creativity farms to improve innovative thinking. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voice of the Family, Creativity, today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Claude Fisher and Keith Hampton about the history of the telephone, how people use their phones today. We want to play a clip from Downton Abbey's season one finale. The house moves into the 20th century with a brand new telephone system. Here's Mr. Carson, played by Jim Carter, practicing answering the telephone.
Hello, this is Downton Abbey. Carson the butler speaking. Hello. This is Mr. Carson, the butler of Downton Abbey. To whom am I speaking? I'm not shouting. Well, who are you? Ah, Mrs. Gaunt. No, I don't want to place a call. I was practicing my answer. Well, I dare say a lot of the things you do sound stupid to other people.
Mr. Carson, learning to answer the telephone. Let me get, looks like Karen from Folsom, PA to join our conversation. Karen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey there.
Hi there.
I was calling because I guess my big worry or concern is about the teenagers today. I have a 14-year-old and they all have cell phones and they don't talk on them. It is all texting. You even suggest, well, why don't you call the person? And they just look at you like, nobody calls you, anybody. Like, oh, my God. And I worry about that because I remember when I was a kid, like, being on the phone for hours with my girlfriend. And I can't say we had deep, meaningful conversations, but I worry that will they be able to connect with each other talking if they will not call anyone on the phone?
Well, Karen, let me toss that first to Keith Hampton. You want to take that, Keith?
Yeah, I mean, I love that we're reminiscing on a time when we talked on the cell phone. I mean, talked on the phone rather than reminiscing on a time when presumably we just hung out with people on the porch or something.
Right.
So, you know, there's certainly some reason to be concerned. And I mean, just because new technologies arrive doesn't mean we can, you know, stop worrying about our children. But there is also, you know, a strong youth culture about engaging through mobile devices, through multiple ways, whether it's texting or on the phone. And that has a lot of value to kids. I mean, it offers a new form of social support with probably a broader group of friends than they were able to maintain through that, you know, one or two long phone calls every night. So, you know, while I certainly recognize the concern there and I think we should balance it, it also, I think, has a lot of value that we're just not really realizing yet.
Claude, does that have a familiar ring to you?
Well, I just find it fascinatingly amusing. I would suspect that people like her parents, were horrified that young people were spending all that time on the telephone when they should be reading or they should be doing chores or they should be listening to their parents and doing uplifting things. It's exactly that kind of behavior that horrified many observers of the telephone, that young teens who would see each other at school would find that they'd still have to come home and keep on yapping on the telephone for hours. And now the generation turns over, and that turns out to be the virtuous way to live, and texting turns out to be the subversive and dangerous way to live. So it's a wonderful example of how these norms change. And I would agree with Keith that there are different ways of communicating. I don't see any evidence that, I don't see any social science evidence that young people who text friends a lot are less likely to talk to their friends face-to-face or get together with their friends. I don't think the one subverts the other. We know that a lot of this electronic communication seems to take time away from television, and that might actually be a good thing.
Karen, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Keith, let me go back to you. And I was reading some Sherry Turkle research, and she comes to, I would say, different conclusions than you do about what people do in public with their cell phones. And she had a study where she looked at mothers with strollers on cell phones, saying instead of talking to their babies or their toddlers, they're talking to who knows who on their telephone. And she thought that was a problem.
Right. Well, I'm not so sure it occurs that often or if it's a problem. I mean, certainly our observations suggest that, you know, the times when people are walking alone, or sorry, they're using their mobile phones is when they're walking alone. And it wasn't too long ago that I had toddlers in baby carriages, and, you know, they face away from me when I push them down the street. I, you know, vividly remember the difficulty of, you know, pushing them through, you know, Cambridge and not being able to navigate the streets with them. So there may be a lot of advantage to be able to use that mobile phone in that time to be able to balance, you know, a work life and a home life in ways that people couldn't do before.
Let me get, looks like Tony from Princeton to join our conversation. Hi, Tony. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I have a story to share with you that is quite appropriate. I'm a teacher, and I recently overheard a conversation between two students. One student expressed to the other a great deal of shock and said, "Can you believe her parents still use a telephone?" And the other student responded by saying, "Isn't that quaint?"
That's a big word, you know, quaint. It's kind of a quaint word. Well, things...
I think it demonstrates that the changes and expansions of our modes of communication vary from generation to generation. And typically the first reaction is one of concern. People were concerned when printing presses started printing the Bible. They were concerned about multiplying heresies. The Greeks were concerned about degradation of human memory when we started reading and writing. I see all the changes that are occurring in communication now as ways of enhancing our capacities for communicating. And we need just time to adjust to the new versions.
Well, Tony, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Claude Fisher, sounds like you and Tony probably see the world in similar ways.
Well, yes, I think that this sequence of a new device comes in, as long as only a small number of people use it in a prescribed way, it's all right. And then when it becomes sort of massified and people start using and adapting it in different ways, it becomes a matter of concern. That was true with the automobile as well as other devices. And it doesn't mean that all technologies, use of all technologies, are benign. And there are side effects that can be of concern. But I do think that the caller is right, that there seems to be, you might say, an automatic assumption that new ways are dangerous ways. And then we go through this phase of worrying, like I'm sure parents of an earlier generation worried about their daughters on the telephone all the time. And we have to learn through research and experience what the new modalities are, how people are adapting, how people are using these things, with what consequences.
Tony, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. An email from Bruce. I didn't think of this. He said Marty mentioned her memory of an operator connecting a phone call. Well, that has come back full circle, except the operator's name now is Siri. Right? Right, Keith Hampton? I mean, Siri is our operator.
Yeah, it's very true. And, you know, I also think that, you know, the students in your caller's class there are probably right that, you know, it is going increasingly quaint to have a landline phone. I mean, over a third of Americans have now completely abandoned landline phones and adopted cell phones as their primary means of voice communication. And within that, you know, another 25% are already relying on fiber and VoIP over IP type communications. So, well, I think that it's quaint. We should also be a little bit concerned in terms of how this infrastructure is changing and how it will react during an emergency and so on. But I don't think it's a new trend. Mm. I think that this is a trend that is fairly well established. And I think we have to consider, you know, what happens in an emergency and how we get very immediate types of social support and not just think about, you know, the kind of day-to-day uses.
And I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Even picking up on texting, and I'll go back to you, Keith, I think one of the advantages that I see is that you can leave someone a message or get a message, but you don't feel this immediate need to respond to it. You can respond in your own time versus that ringing phone.
Well, I'm glad you don't feel that pressure, but I do.
Oh, you do? Oh, that's interesting.
I say when I get a text, I feel a lot of pressure to respond very, very quickly, and I think my anxiety increases the longer I wait. I can ignore my kids for a little while, but I certainly can't ignore a text from my wife for more than a few minutes.
Oh, Claude, any response to that?
Well, these things are interesting about the timing issue, and if you have time, I also mentioned something about the operator issue. But there was an important moment when voicemail came in, the voice recording device, and I can recall that for many people this was a major change, even though we hardly talk about it. But it used to be that you either got the telephone call or you didn't get the telephone call. And if you didn't get the telephone call, all sorts of things were on hold, and the caller was irritated and had to keep trying and trying. And then we got voice recording, the telephone recording devices, which meant two things. One is you didn't miss the call, and the other thing it meant is you could ignore the call. That is, you could just let the machine take the message. And people got a lot more control over the timing of things through that that kind of device. So this was a sort of not a revolutionary change in telephone calling, but it did create sort of new habits and new styles of interacting, most of which were in the direction of greater control over the technology.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We are talking about the various ways that people use their telephones and the kind of ambivalence on some people's part on this technology and some, of course, who embrace it full throttle. Let me see what Phil from Newtown Square has to say. Phil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I just wanted to call because I found the show very interesting. I remember beginning of the answering machine. I remember party lines when I was a kid. I can laugh, and I joked with my daughters who in the 1990s went to the place, and they still had a party line at this place, you know, on the lake. And they were like, they came back and told their friends at school, and their friends are like, what planet were you on? But I also can look and say that, and joke a little bit about the answering machine, that was the beginning or of the end of civilization, where used to be people would call you, and if they didn't catch you, they had to call you back. And if they wasn't really important, they'd write you a letter and support the post office. Well, once they started leaving messages, they took their problem and made it your problem. And everything that came after that, pagers, cell phones.
Oh, dear, Phil, you're really down on this stuff. Let me give our guests a chance to weigh in. Keith, since you're across from me, I mean, Phil's not alone who see this technology really as a ruination in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, again, I totally sympathize. I mean, part of the shift away from kind of home-to-home communication is this shift again from person to person, and you're guaranteed to get that person now. There's no doubt, right? I mean, there's a message left, there's a text sent. You're fairly certain that the person got it, and being able to ignore that communication is very difficult. It has all sorts of implications for surveillance of teenagers when they're out and about, and it has all sorts of implications for romantic interests as well. I mean, you know when your partner's not around and not answering their call, and
what could they be doing?
What could they be doing? And the same for your kids. I mean, what could they be doing to not be able to respond to your text message so quickly?
I do have a pet peeve, Claude Fisher, for all my love for my cell phone, are the distracted drivers. I mean, the fact that people are on their cell phone, sometimes apparently texting and driving at the same time. What do we do about that?
Well, I don't know about that thing in particular, but I do think it does point out that one of the stories about new technologies is that there's always a period of adjustment. That clip you played from Downton Abbey about learning how to speak on the phone, voice modulation, what the proper ways to start a phone conversation, end a phone conversation, these are all kinds of things that occur in the early years of a technology's adoption until people get into the right habits and find their way. And that's also why the telephone company did clips like the one you played about how to use a rotary phone. And the Bell company was in the business of handing out booklets in schools on how children should learn to use the telephone, not only the mechanical aspects of it, but the social aspects of it. Who should answer the phone? Who should start in a conversation? What are the proper words you can use? What are the language you shouldn't use? So I think we're with regard to the cell phone / smartphone, I think we're still finding our way in getting the right habits down that make that smoothly interactions and make it a much more seamless experience.
Keith, it's interesting, and I kind of anticipated this before we did the show, which is that both you and Claude see some of the many of the upsides of the telephone, and our callers largely see the downside. How do you see this disconnect?
Well, there does seem to be a real disconnect between our kind of standard concern about the rise of new technologies and the social science data. And I think that this largely has to do with, our anecdotal evidence of seeing, examples that are most part rare of things that go wrong with these technologies, and then the kind of large-scale social trends towards how these technologies are changing us. And we often forget that there are, so many other things going on in society at the same time and acting in, on the same outcomes. And those are often, far more, interesting from a sociological point of view, more mundane, really. And they tend to matter a lot for these outcomes. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be thinking about how these technologies are affecting relationships and that we shouldn't have concerns about them. I mean, I certainly worry about, the rare time when I'm touching my cell phone in the car and looking at the GPS, what I'm demonstrating to my children, and thinking about, how my norms of using this are going to impact them when they're teenage drivers. And we should be aware of that, but at the same time, I don't think we need to be overly alarmist in that technology change in general tends to happen at such a slow pace.
Keith Hampton, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times, Associate Professor in the Department of Communication at Rutgers University. Claude Fisher, thank you very much for joining us as well.
You're welcome.
And he's a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including a podcast, Facebook, email, Twitter, archives, and how to listen to the show on satellite radio. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant with Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us.